Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Carol Brown of Westwood Hills plays the bass, but here's what's also interesting about Carol Brown. She lives in a one-room cabin in the Flint Hills with no modern conveniences, and that means no electricity, car, or running water. She's been there at least half of the year, and she's been doing it for 12 years. We'll visit with Carol later on this hour. But first up, milk and cookies disease, which sounds like an oxymoron, but it's actually not. Dr. Julie Way coined that phrase after years of treating children referred to her with ear, nose, and throat complaints that mimicked actual infections and illness. Often these patients were on several medications but weren't showing improvement. Dr. Way's prescription, no more milk and cookies before bedtime. The results are often stunning. Dr. Julie Way joins us now. She's an ear, nose, and throat specialist who practices at both the University of Kansas Medical Center as well as at Children's Mercy Hospital. Her book, A Healthier Way, describes her approach. And Julie, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's begin with some of the kids you profile at the beginning of your book, A Healthier Way. You write about 15-year-old Aiden, Jenna, who's age 14 when you treated her, and Braden, who was age 9. Tell us about these kids and what they were up against.
Yeah, Steve, I'd be happy to. Aiden actually is 15 months old. The reason I put in three patients of various age is to demonstrate the fact that what I observe over the years affect children of all different ages, and both boys and girls. For example, Aiden, this is very typical for someone who do what I do for a living. They come in with moms who are frustrated because these toddlers are chronically congested. So they can't breathe. They don't feel good.
And moms can't figure out what to do, right?
Well, they've gone to their primary doctor, and then they've often seen several other specialists and have tried several medications like nasal steroid spray, Flonase is what people hear of, or taking Claritin. So despite these medications, their child's not better. So by the time they get to me, a lot has been tried.
Mm-hmm. And mom and dad just don't know what to do. And what do you do? How do you proceed from there?
So I have to admit, starting out, I'm trained in Western, medicine, and I'm a surgeon, so it has taken me years to experience this career epiphany. When I realized and started asking questions so much more than just their symptom, very often you start to find out they have issues related to eating, what they eat, what they don't eat, how often they're eating. I started asking questions about what time they're eating. So, for example, in the book, Aiden, who's 15 months, in addition to always being congested and having a runny nose, he would vomit very frequently. And he sounds like a, we kindly joke about the Darth Vader noise.
Yeah. And he made that all the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm. And, you don't have to be a physician to know that that's not normal. And you can't have a cold 365 days a year. As I started asking questions, that's how I find out, very typical of other toddlers, he wasn't sleeping through the night. He can't breathe well. He's not comfortable. And when he would wake and is upset, often he would be given a bottle.
Hmm.
And so this is
that contained milk.
That's right. So he mm-hmm. would get milk. And so while that may soothe them possibly to go back to sleep, the sleep is never sustained for several hours. He'd wake up with either more congestion, cough, even vomiting. So the mm-hmm. cycle continues every night and every day.
And so what did you do with Aiden?
So the first is to have a very kind and gentle, non-judgmental conversation with the parents and families, because I want them to know that I'm a mother and I'm sympathetic. And what I'm sharing, even if it's not proven by the traditional science, clinical trials and research, I tell them that the reasons why I think the feeding is related and the timing of the feeding is related. And after I explain that, I offer my suggestions to stop the middle of the night feeding. I explain to them that it takes time for milk to leave the stomach. We don't think about that. Once you eat, you think it just moves on and that's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it's because they're going to sleep with undigested food and milk in their stomach. Then if it comes back up, you're going to have problems.
Mm-hmm. And so with Aiden, when you gave the parents this amount of advice, how did he react to the new regimen that he was suddenly on?
So the first is, I will admit that at times the parents come to me saying, I have a very sick child. We have seen several people, have had several tests done. We've been on many medications. Are you sure this is just diet? That just sounds too simple and too good to be true. But I have to admit, these parents are frustrated and desperate. So they're willing, thankfully, to listen to one more suggestion. So I tell them also, not only that if your toddler wakes up in the middle of the night, don't feed again, but at bedtime. Mm-hmm. You know, so often you get out of infancy, parents are, it's very easy to still be in the mindset of giving milk at bedtime, mm-hmm. As a comfort measure. So we would stop that. And I always bring my families back to see me again with the child in 4 to 6 weeks, because that's how I know if what I'm saying may or may not impact what happens to them.
Well, what happened in Aiden's case?
So Aiden's case, mom came back and they just share with me, they're very enthusiastic. They tell me, well, we cannot believe it. Within 1 week, within the first 3 days, nights when we stop giving the milk at bedtime and stop giving it to them in the middle of the night, and we do talk about strategies for how to soothe the child if they wake up crying and won't go back to sleep, because parents assume that, are you kidding me? If I don't give them the milk, no one's going to go back to sleep. And they tell me that the congestion cleared up, the nose is not as runny, he's throwing up less when we decrease the overall amount of milk consumed throughout the entire day, and much more likely to start eating more solid foods, as you would expect for their age. And more importantly, he was a different child. He just seemed happier.
So no medications, no new drugs, just a different eating pattern here.
Absolutely. I know that people may misinterpret the term milk and cookie disease as if I'm saying absolutely no milk and cookie allowed. And I would never dare to do that. I would have many, many
it's
patients.
Anti-American. It's anti-American. It's anti-whatever it is. Yeah.
That's exactly right. What I'm really wanting to do, Steve, is have a conversation with America, with parents and caretakers, and say, you know, we're all very busy, but it is time that we really focus on what we're feeding our children, how we help them to learn to decide what to eat, when to eat, and equally important, when not to eat, and develop habits that are important for our health lifelong.
Dr. Julie Way is our guest. Her book is titled A Healthier Way. We're talking about milk and cookies disease and this pattern of feeding kids at bedtime and in the middle of the night and the problems that can sometimes cause. Does this condition sound familiar to you? Would you try eliminating milk, cookies, and other foods before bedtime? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So you came up with this neat name, Julie, for this ailment, milk and cookies disease. Where'd you come up with it? Or was it just so obvious?
Well, it started because I had several anecdotes, some very dramatic stories. For example, a patient who had been diagnosed with croup. You've heard of croup, mm-hmm. that barky cough. This particular child had experienced it 27 times. I mean, that is extraordinary. And they're documented by visits to our local hospital, urgent care, or emergency room. Mm-hmm. They have had so much steroids, because that's the conventional treatment to decrease the theoretical swelling in the voice box. And I really asked this family what the child's eating habits. And it's not just at night. I ask what they eat all day long, but I focus specifically in the evenings from the time after dinner into bedtime, because this is where you, with children, they eat, they go to bed earlier. You don't have a lot of time for food to finish digesting and get out of the stomach. So mm-hmm. they're at much higher risk of having backwash or reflux. And I found out that this child, for many, many years, they can't remember, every single night, it was the habit for them to have chocolate chip cookies and milk. Mm. And that's why I initially coined the term. But it's so much, but really, milk and cookies to me represent the two categories of food that cause, that puts us at risk and our children at risk, and that is dairy and sugar.
And people wonder why. We're talking a lot about milk here. What's so tricky about milk?
You know, what's tricky about milk, if you think about it, is number one, culturally, we know that we Americans are taught and the benefits of dairy and calcium and vitamin D. And in fact, only 1-2% of the pediatric population may truly be allergic to the cow milk protein, where you would say, gosh, you're allergic. But having lactose intolerance, that's an entirely different story. It's been reported up to 60% of the population may have lactose intolerance.
And I'm raising my hand right now. I'm one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And being of Chinese descent, you know, we Asians, of course, experience that very frequently. What I find is because out of the intention to love our children and provide them nutrition, you're told milk is good for you, dairy, cheese, yogurt. So better, more is better, right? And mm-hmm. so parents do not typically think about what the total amount it is that their children are eating. And often families will even say to me, well, my kid doesn't drink that much milk. But if we take the time to write down and think about, reflect on what your child consumes all day,
it can be surprising how much it is.
There's quite a bit.
Let's go to some phone calls here with Dr. Julie Way. Let's go to Heather from Gardner. Heather, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment. I have two boys, and when I was growing up, I would have these horrible migraines, like from 6 on, and I would have to take this pain medicine and go to bed, and I would get nauseous, the whole nine yards. And as I've gotten older, it took me having my second child, and he had like reflux, and I was breastfeeding, so he said, okay, cut out all your dairy. Well, all my headaches went away. So what we realized is that I guess it thickens milk and dairy, thickens your mucus, and I was getting chronic sinus infections, which was causing me to get really, really sick and have migraines. And my oldest son started having these headaches too. So I cut my entire family off milk and put them on soy milk, and I drink almond milk because of the, you know, the breast cancer factors. And we haven't had any problems since. It's been a miracle. I just cannot tell people. I think we're the only animals or mammals that drink another animal's breast milk. And I just don't know necessarily if that's good for us. So I'll just take my response off here. Thank you.
Yeah, Heather, thank you.
Heather, thank you so much for sharing that. What I'm hearing from you is very typical. Now, while scientifically I'm not going to get into whether migraines can be contributed by milk, what I do see every day in clinic is children who are eating too close to bedtime, especially high acidity foods, especially from dairy and sugar, they will spend possibly the entire night having severe congestion. And we are built to breathe through our nose because that's how you humidify the air. That's how you breathe comfortably. Imagine you can't sleep when you have a bad cold and you're stuffed up. You can have headaches just from chronically having nasal congestion. We mm-hmm. all know what that feels like. Your head feels terrible. So thank you for sharing that. That's exactly my experience as a physician.
Let's go back to some phone calls. 816-235-2888. Brian from Mission. Brian, you're on Up to Date. Good morning. You there, Brian? He used to be a huge milk drinker, but he switched to other products. What are substitute products for milk if you can't drink milk?
Heather mentioned earlier soy milk, and soy milk actually is very common as part of my childhood and upbringing, and it's fortified with vitamin D and calcium, mm-hmm. so you're certainly not lacking in benefits there. She made a comment about risk to breast cancer. I just want to make sure our audience knows that I know there's been some concern for link of estrogen from soy products. That's an entire other discussion, but certainly no clear link.
And there's rice and almond milk
rice,
as well.
Rice, almond, coconut. So those are some other options as well.
And
finally,
those...
just water. Maybe just no milk.
Do you recommend those for infants?
No. I always, you know, remind the parents that I ask them to always check with their primary care physician and their pediatricians. You know, babies need to have breast milk or formula, and they also need the fats. That's the one thing that is in milk up to age 2, which will help with their neural development. So I don't want our audience to think that I'm advocating cutting off all dairy. You know, my book is really not about living life black and white, but really everything in moderation. And I'm not trying to take your child's cookies and milk and ice cream away.
But just really rethinking a little bit and examining exactly what you're doing and maybe the problems that it could cause then.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you want to educate America, but you also need to educate doctors and how they're handling these kinds of cases when they come in to see them all across the country. How do you go about doing that?
Steve, that's a wonderful point, and thank you for bringing that up. You know, I would never dare to imply that the other doctors are not doing things correctly or without good intention. I have come to realize that somebody like myself as a specialist and working with other specialists, often we're thinking in our own box. So when a child comes into your office, if you're a gastroenterology or, you know, GI doctor, then that physician, I would expect, if we're trained in Western medicine, to look at your symptoms and say, gee, what does that fit in my group of diagnoses that I'm trained to treat? Mm-hmm. And we try to grab a diagnose, you know, we try to make our best guess at what diagnosis in my area would fit your symptom. And often we just have different perspectives. So I'll give you an example. I'll have patients that see a GI doctor, then their child may even have symptoms bad enough that they get a scope and get a biopsy. But the mom's told, oh, the biopsy was normal. Your child does not have reflux. I respectfully disagree with that statement. They may not have disease proven by the biopsy, but that's because they haven't had, thankfully, the years of acid and damage, possibly to the lining of the esophagus and stomach. But if that child had milk and cookies right at bedtime and happened to start coughing and having runny nose, that doesn't mean they didn't have reflux. They had it. If you have pizza and beer close to bedtime, I guarantee that you might experience some symptoms. Mm-hmm. But children very often have these symptoms differently. They don't tell you they have heartburn. They don't, you know, in my world, it's all congestion up in the nose and in the head. And I want to go back to what Heather said about sinus infection. That is so important as a part of my life is to provide education to the families, because I have to tell you, the overuse of antibiotics for the assumption that the clogged up, not working nose is because of an acute infection, and children are given 21 days of antibiotics at a time. And if that doesn't work, another 21 days of stronger antibiotic, which then further, you know, can be detrimental to their digestive process.
Yeah.
That is something I really try very hard to help.
And you set up by to adults as well? Because I always get one or two of those things. What I think that is every winter, and I call my doc and I say, I need an antibiotic, and I usually get one. And it usually seems to help. Or am I fooling myself?
As a ear, nose, throat specialist, and I can tell you that as uncomfortable as it is, I often share with the parents that the true definition of an acute sinus infection, you know, you can read this on the American Academy of Pediatrics. You should be having fever, 103, 104, several days in a row.
Wow.
Oftentimes after 7 or 10 days of cold symptoms that don't go away, you're generally, I describe it as being sick as a dog, you know, meaning you can't get out of bed, your head's pounding. That is not what I'm seeing in children. These children are prescribed antibiotics when they didn't miss school. The nasal congestion is going on for weeks and months. They still go to sports practice. They still do whatever they do. They just don't feel good.
They have a cold.
They have cold symptoms that they may not have a cold. And in my experience, no amount of antibiotics they've been prescribed has been helpful. You know,
and applying
it's
this
tough.
To adults as well, it sounds like.
Yes, I think it's challenging. I find that it's hard to see inside the nose and the sinuses, so it's a difficult organ system to understand, and there's still some misconceptions there. My scientific research has really focused on chronic sinus symptoms in children, and I've demonstrated how just flushing the nose without any medication has been incredibly useful in treating the symptoms, but more importantly, to show that it's a condition of inflammation, not acute bacterial infection. And if it's not an acute bacterial infection, then antibiotics have no role.
Well, Julie, I'm just wondering if your findings here when it comes to your name for all this, milk and cookies disease, is that symptomatic of a larger problem in medicine where doctors are quick to prescribe medication for conditions that may not require medication? And, you know, we're so well trained almost in our culture. You don't feel well, you call your doctor, you want a drug to take care of what you have, because psychologically, if nothing else, that's going to make you feel better.
Steve, you really explained that very well. That's exactly my overall message in the book. You know, I'm trained in Western medicine. I think that we have been trained to treat illness, not necessarily to treat health or reclaim health. And clearly, there's been a huge movement and a mandate for us to move in that direction. And culturally, we as physicians are faced with the pressure. You almost feel like you're family are not happy or they're disappointed if they call or they come in and they even say to you, hey, I came here today to get this prescription.
Yes.
So
yes,
as uncomfortable and as difficult as it is, I have made it a personal mission to take the time to have a conversation with people
mm-hmm.
because I think they're open to it if you explain to them why professionally, scientifically, and even based on my research, that is not the best option for their child. And parents nowadays over the years are much more educated. They hear it about mm-hmm. the detriments of having too much antibiotics and development of resistance in the U.S. where we have some pretty scary things where, you know, it's hard to find a drug that works. And so, you know, it's not a simple issue. But I do want to empower families to say, you know what, let's start with the basics.
I'm just wondering how difficult it is, Julie, to tell the difference between a fairly minor, what could be a minor problem, milk and cookies disease, and treating that symptom versus something that maybe is a more serious issue in the intestines, in the stomach, in the whole digestive tract altogether. How do you draw that distinction when you see a young person who perhaps has a hard time articulating what he or she is up against?
Steve, that's an excellent question. So let me share, for example, what I do clinically in real life as a physician and surgeon. When a child comes in, and tomorrow I think I will see 40 patients and their families, and easily a third to a half may come in with nasal congestion as their primary symptom.
Mm-hmm.
I ask them in detail about their feeding habits, and I certainly do a good exam to look for things that are actually wrong, you know, to my eyes about their ear, nose, and throat area. And if I don't see anything anatomically wrong or in my heart, you know, my instinct tells me based on my work and my experience that this child may truly have the milk and cookie disease, I make those recommendations, modify that, and I bring them back. If they're better, there's no need. I get to avoid ordering expensive CT scan, minimizing radiation exposure.
Right.
You know, if they're better, their parents will be the first to tell you that they're better.
Mm-hmm.
Parents are not going to lie to make me feel better about myself. If they're not better, then at least I've made that change. And then we go ahead and then look at the next steps. So the treatment and prescription from my end has become a very much conservative and stepwise approach.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is, hey, you know what? Better dietary habits will help you have good health, whether you're sick or not, and especially when you're sick.
You know, when you sit down with a parent, as we leave our conversation here, Julie, what should parents know? How can you help them draw a distinction here between a more serious problem and milk and cookies disease? What kind of questions do you ask when a family comes in to see you? Because you have a whole checklist in your book, A Healthier Way, the questions that you run through here.
I generally ask them, what time is dinner time? And what time is bedtime?
Mm-hmm.
And even if it varies a little bit day to day based on activities, I like to have an idea. There are many families who will let me know because of their busy lives, the child literally finishes dinner within 60 minutes of bedtime. We know that the stomach may take 4 to 6 hours before finishing all that digestion. So I need to first look at that. I always ask, are they in the habit of having a bedtime snack? And it doesn't have to be milk, just milk and cookies. But again, it could be yogurt. Cereal and milk is a huge one. Cheese sticks is another children's favorite.
Yeah.
And so when we identify those things, then I offer my suggestions to modify that, to eliminate that, to really also focus on how much milk they drink a day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm astounded by young preschool age kids drinking over 40 ounces of milk a day.
Mm.
I mean, that's way more than what's recommended.
What is recommended?
I think for up to, once you're older than age 2, probably about 14 ounces a day is what's recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
The parents think, oh, milk is good. It's the more the better, right? It's the magic formula here. Yeah. Email here from Cindy. As a daughter of a dairy farmer, I feel strongly that dairy is a healthy food for all ages unless there is an allergy. However, my 21-year-old daughter has had ear and throat issues her entire life since going on a low-acid diet for silent excellent reflux. Her symptoms are completely controlled. She does not eat within 3 hours of going to bed and does not consume any caffeine, carbonated beverages, acidic fruit, chocolate, or tomatoes, and a big difference in her life, it sounds like. Just what you're talking about here.
Yes, absolutely. And again, I don't mean to say that, you know, there's one single food or category that's the culprit. It's really about not just any particular item, and people's bodies respond differently to different things.
Right.
But the timing is every bit as critical.
There's lots more information in Julie's book, A Healthier Way, that talks about diets for kids, good recipes for kids, everything else in that book as well. Julie, thanks so much for coming in today. So good to have you.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's been a pleasure.
That's Dr. Julie Way. She practices at both the University of Kansas Medical Center and at Children's Mercy Hospital. It's time for a break. When we come back, a woman who lives in the Flint Hills 6 months a year with no modern conveniences. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.